Hi, everybody. I'm Linda Laurel, and this is Our Voices Matter, a podcast dedicated to reminding us of our common humanity. And I would venture to say that over these last few weeks and months, we have certainly been reminded of that as we are all living with life in the age of COVID-19. As of this taping on April 27th, 2020, there are more than 55,000 Americans who have been killed by this virus, and that number is still rising. Here in the Houston area, we have lost 188 souls to this virus, including the father of our guest today. Please welcome James Campbell, a former journalist with the Houston Chronicle and current executive with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas, and someone that I've known for a long time. And James, first, let me just say my condolences to you and your family. I can't even imagine what you're going through.
Thank you, Linda, for having me, first of all. And thank you for your condolences. As you might imagine, it's been a difficult time, but my family and I are moving forward. My mom is good. My sisters are good. So the main thing for us now is making sure that my mom stays healthy and does the right thing to not get exposed like my dad, because she's 85 years old and my dad was 88. And, you know, it affects people who are older. And so our main mission now is to make sure that she's protected.
Do you know how your father contracted the virus?
So, you know, we've been trying to do our own forensics on that to determine how he got COVID-19. The week prior to that, you know, my dad, they didn't do anything but go to the doctors. That was one of their things that they liked doing, was going to visit doctors, and as well as their church activities. But he had been to the physician's office that week, and I think they may have stopped at a grocery store, but we just don't know because the symptoms didn't really start to manifest until, and you know, that's an incubation period, but you know, we don't really know. It could have been one of the many grandkids or great grandkids who stopped by. It could have been community spread. It could have been, you know, in the doctor's office. We just don't know.
And that's what's so frightening about this disease, is that we don't know, because you can be a carrier and asymptomatic and passing it on to someone without your knowledge. And that's what's so frightening, one of the many things that's frightening about it. What kind of symptoms did your dad have?
So my mom is a retired RN, registered nurse. And, you know, when he started, it started off as kind of fatigue, and he thought maybe he had some type of virus, you know, that would run its course, and my mom, or some type of bacterial infection, and my mom gave him a Z-Pak, and he started to feel a little better, but he started to, you know, started to cough a little, not much. He was really fatigued, really slow. You know, my dad was really quick when it came to, you know, his thinking, but he just was not himself. He started to really decline, I would say, on a Thursday before he went into the hospital. And my mom nursed him that weekend from that Thursday until that Monday. But you know, she wasn't, I mean, she did everything in her toolkit to understand what was going on with him. But then, you know, it got to the point, Linda, where his breathing became very shallow. And that's when she knew, you know, I don't have the skill set, yeah. not the equipment to do anything. And that's when she decided to call the paramedics. Now, having said that, the paramedics came out two times before that. And before they actually took him to the hospital, there was some, you know, fear that if he went to a COVID unit, that we would not be able to see him, because the paramedics warned my mom that once they took him to, if we think that he has, you know, COVID-19 or the virus, then, you know, once he left here, you weren't going to be able to see him. And that was not something that sat well with my mom or my sisters or me, frankly. But that's the reality of it. And I think the thing that finally made her make the decision to call the paramedics and allow him to go to a hospital was when his depth of breathing became very shallow. And that was nothing that she could really do about that. And so, you know, they took him, and what she feared actually became realized, because we, once he became, you know, a patient in the COVID unit at CHI St. Luke's, we couldn't see him. And that was part of her fear.
I can't even imagine having to make that kind of a decision. Do you make sure that your loved one gets the care that they need, but also knowing that it could very well be the last time that you get to see them? How do you even wrap your mind around that?
It's difficult, because that is probably the worst piece of this whole COVID-19 pandemic, is that, you know, your loved ones literally, you know, are cared for in isolation. And some of them, like my dad, subsequently die in isolation. And it's really hard, because once he went into the hospital, they immediately took him to the COVID unit, but we weren't sure if he was positive for COVID, because he went in on a Monday morning. And they did a swab, but we didn't find out until that Wednesday night that he had tested positive for COVID-19. And so at that point, you know, before that, they were treating him like they normally treat pneumonia patients, because when you go into the COVID unit, they treat the symptoms of the virus, which is pneumonia, shallow breathing. That's why they immediately intubate patients and put them on a ventilator, so they could help them with their breathing and help protect their lungs. Because once the disease attacks their lungs, it's almost always downhill. And if you come back from that, you still have some damage, you know, to your lungs. But mm-hmm. they started treating those symptoms. And then, you know, we were optimistic, because he went in a bad way, and then he rallied until Wednesday. And then on Wednesday, that's when the physicians made the decision to put him on a regimen of hydroxychloroquine, which was the so-called miracle drug at the time.
Really?
Did it
do anything for him?
No. In fact, in hindsight, we realized my dad had a bit of a heart arrhythmia already, and he had been fitted with a pacemaker. And, you know, we, you know, subsequently learned that, you know, people who are treated with hydroxychloroquine that exacerbates people with heart conditions. And yeah. So, you know, we yeah. didn't really know that. But when you are trying to, you know, make decisions about saving your loved ones, you do anything to try to get them well. And so we thought, okay, this miracle drug, the so-called miracle drug, was going to help him. But the reality is it may be helping some, but it's not helping all. And we know anecdotally now by some studies that have been done in New York and elsewhere that it could in fact be harmful to the process. And yes. So, you know, it's really, you know, difficult for the physicians and caretakers who are literally learning on the fly how to deal with these, with COVID-19. I was reading a story today in USA Today where they've issued more symptoms to look for. So even as we try to treat what we know about it, it continues to evolve in terms of, you know, knowing when you might even have the virus. So, you know, going into a situation like that, you basically handed him over and hope for the best. And, you know, my wife is a physician, and we were privy to a lot of stuff that, you know, regular families maybe not were privy to, because she could talk physician to physician, mm-hmm. having worked in an emergency room and had patients in an emergency room, was able to talk to them about, you know, what they were doing and the processes and the pharmaceuticals that they were using. And, you know, the doctors in that COVID unit and the caretakers were literally in a race against time for everybody that came into the unit, because they were trying everything in that toolkit to try to save the people who were in the COVID unit, not knowing if something would work or not work. Right. And so, you know, the COVID units at most hospitals are essentially experimental labs where people are just trying to figure it out and treat, you know, conditions like lungs and heart and kidney.
So James, how long ago has it been now since your dad was admitted to the hospital?
He was admitted on, I want to say, the 27th.
It's been almost a month or so. So a lot has happened even in that month.
Yes.
Since he was admitted, in terms of what doctors have been able to learn and just, you know, experiment with to see. So from the time your dad was admitted, and you realized that things were not good, how much longer did it take before he ultimately passed?
It was 8 days, basically.
8 days. Yeah. Wow.
And, you know, I think 8 days, you know, was pretty, pretty good, actually, because when he went in the hospital on that Monday, and as I said, he rallied. And then when they started the COVID treatment, that's when he started to, the hydroxychloroquine treatment, that's when he really started to decline. And, you know, he rallied a little bit that Friday and then, you know, a little bit Saturday, but he was still in that danger zone. He never came out of the danger zone, basically. But we got a call that Sunday night, probably early in the morning. You know, you don't really sleep well. And, you know, and the other part of it was, you know, since family had been around him, we were all quarantining and living our own isolated existence at the same time that we were waiting on these phone calls for either positive or negative news. And we got that call early Sunday morning to come to the hospital to visit, because this may be your last time to visit him.
And did you actually get to go into the room with him?
So we got the call, and my wife and I, my mom, my sisters, all were heading to the hospital, and my wife was talking directly to the physician who was in charge of the emergency room that night. And, you know, we basically thought we had lost him and we were just going to see him for the last time. And we got the call that he was, he had rallied and he was still, you know, fighting. And so that gave us optimism on that Sunday, early morning. But when we got up to the hospital, they basically dress you in head from head to toe in PPE gear so mm-hmm. you could go into the COVID unit. My sisters and my mom went into the COVID unit. I made the decision, Linda, to not go into the COVID unit because once you see something like that, you can't unsee it. And I did not want to see my dad like that. My last memory of him was, you know, talking. He actually got up out of the bed and to get onto the paramedics gurney. And you know, he was actually lucid and, you know, alert when they took him. And my last memory, I wanted it to be of him being alert and alive. And I did not want to see him intubated and in that condition. They literally had to put him in a coma in order to administer all of this medicine and treatment during his time in the ER, I mean, in the COVID unit. So I told my sisters that I was not going in because I, you know, you can't unsee that. And my youngest sister said later that I wish I hadn't gone in because you're right, you can't unsee something like that. Yeah. And so anyway, so we went in that early Sunday morning, and after we left the hospital about maybe 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, which we were told, you know, they actually were quite lenient with our family because you on that floor at St. Luke's, they don't allow anybody to even sit in the waiting room. If under normal conditions, if you have a loved one in the hospital, you could literally sleep in the lobby in the waiting room, and they even have some units that have beds or cots where, you know, the family members can sleep.
Not in this case.
No, yeah. Not in the COVID unit. The hospital was literally a ghost town. There was nobody around except, you know, some staff to let people in and out. They were checking your temperature going in, and we checked that temperature coming out. But, you know, it's just, you left the hospital and you were wondering, okay, is he going to make it now? And my wife and I decided that we would just go and get a COVID test because we didn't know. My mom and my sisters had gone 2 days before that on a Friday to get their test. And, so we drove out to Katy to a testing facility and got tested that Sunday.
Please tell me that everyone's negative.
Yes, everyone turned out to be negative.
Good. But,
yeah, but you know, as I always tell my sisters, just because you tested negative doesn't mean you won't subsequently test negative. So,
and they're also false positives and false negatives, and that's one of the difficulties is that we can't even rely on the test necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so you have to be vigilant about, you know, protecting yourself, but particularly if you're in that demographic where you're most susceptible to it.
So James, I know you and your dad were very close.
Yes. That was my road dog for the Texans games and all things sports and politics and everything else.
What do you want people to know about him?
You know, he was just a good guy, Linda. He wasn't, you know, educated in a sense that, you know, he went to a college and, you know, got a degree and, you know, whatever. But he was, you know, really a PhD when it came to life and taking care of his family and making sure that he raised, you know, five kids to be, you know, good citizens, contributing to society, not complaining about stuff, to be very spiritual, and, you know, to, you know, really respect everybody, you know, no matter what race, creed, or color, when he had every right to be bitter about not having opportunities himself to go to college. You know, he worked to put, you know, five kids through college. All of us, except for one, graduated from college. Most of us have, you know, multiple degrees. And so, you know, and he loved his family. You know, he just brag about his grandkids and great grandkids and great grand great great grandkids, and he was just a very social person, Linda, and could talk about anything. Was an avid newspaper reader and news consumer.
He must have been so proud of your years as a journalist.
Yeah, it was funny. You know, when I was growing up, you know, we took the Post and the Chronicle. The Post was the morning paper and the Chronicle was the evening paper. And I was an avid reader of the sports section. I just thought, I am going to be a sports writer one day. And so I just loved reading the sports page. And he wanted to make sure that I, you know, got my school studies done. And he forbade me from, you know, going and reading the newspaper in the morning. And so when the Post would drop on the driveway about 4 a.m. in the morning, I would get up. I would hit a gentle thud on the driveway. I'd get up, go read the paper in the living room, roll it back up, and throw it in the yard. And years later.
I love it. Oh, my gosh.
And years later, I told him about that. He said, I never knew that. He said, no wonder you became a general.
Oh, so my gosh. You were born to do that.
Yeah,
he never knew that.
He was really tickled when he learned that I used to do that. But he was just a good guy. He was born in Ponchatoula Parish, Louisiana, and raised in New Orleans, and moved to Houston, worked as a truck driver at Grocer Supply for almost 40 years. He was a long-haul truck driver. And, you know, I think, you know, if he were a younger man in this moment, he would be one of those essential workers out delivering groceries to people who need it. You know, he was very active in his church, and he loved to travel. He and my mom used to travel everywhere when they were younger. I had a sister who worked for Delta Airlines and another sister who worked for Marriott. And so they used to travel, you know.
They got all those perks, huh? they got all the travel perks.
And they definitely took advantage of it. And they were very social. Very many social clubs. And
I would imagine that one of the most difficult parts of this whole experience is the fact that you're not able to have a funeral right now to celebrate his life. And I'm sure you envisioned something much different than what is happening right now. How are you dealing with that? And what happens at this point? How do you go about grieving your dad? And what's involved with this now? This is all uncharted territory for all of us.
Right. So that was one of the hardest things to reconcile. We did have a funeral service at a funeral home. It was just the immediate family, meaning the kids and their spouses. And that was it. You know, people could go and view, and they set up a protocol where people could two at a time go in to a viewing that we had at a funeral home. But my dad never imagined that, you know, Christian people who go to church, and, you know, my grandmother always said to us, you live your funeral, you know, meaning that the way you live your life, that's the way people would celebrate you when you died. Well, my dad never expected to be celebrated at a funeral home where we as a family had to, you know, eulogize him, because the minister, was in an empty church 15 miles away doing a virtual eulogy on FaceTime while the family, you know, had to look at that eulogy on a on a computer that we brought to the funeral home. And we couldn't even go to the gravesite. My dad was a World War II veteran. And, you know, he expected to get that, you know, the honor guard and the ceremonial send-off, military send-off. What he got was, after the funeral, they loaded the body on into a hearse and, you know, dropped it off at the gravesite, and the family could not, you know, be there to have a graveside service. But we are planning a celebration of life once we get back to some sense of normalcy, where we can have family and friends and ex-co-workers, those that are alive, and church members who admired him. You know, we'll have a celebration of life. And, you know, I already told my mom, my dad was just a masterful barbecuer. He could, you know, he had this state-of-the-art pit built in the backyard. And I told my mom, I got, the thing weighs a ton, but I told my mom I got first dibs on that, you know, and I'm going to have a truck come out, and then I'm going to, you know, barbecue some stuff for family and friends, because my dad loved to do barbecues for family and friends. And I'm gonna get that old thing painted up and taken care of and barbecue for him. But we plan to have a celebration of life down the road. And then we're going to have a graveside service once they start allowing people into the Veterans Memorial Cemetery. But understandably, they aren't allowing those types of congregations.
So, James, put your journalist hat on for a moment and tell me what your thoughts are about how the media are covering COVID and just kind of where we are in this whole process from a seasoned journalist's perspective. I know you're no longer practicing, so you probably can speak a little bit more freely than you might otherwise. So I would really like to know what you think.
So I think that the media has been doing a pretty good job given the limitations. Everybody's learning on the fly. I mean, what you're doing is not unlike what most networks and most local channels are doing. Most reporters, newspaper reporters, are interviewing people by phone, which is the old way people used to do it anyway. I mean, we used to go to scenes, but, you know, now you have to basically interview people via Zoom or by phone. I think that one of the emerging stories, Linda, and I hope that this doesn't get lost in the larger story, is how people of color are starting to own COVID-19. And I think that, you know, people get caught up in job losses, the economic impact of this. And, you know, sometimes you can forget about the human loss. And, you know, everybody is paying a price, especially people who lose people in this environment. And so I think that, you know, while I'm as concerned as anybody about the economic impact, you can't really, you know, go back to normal until you figure out the science on COVID-19. You know, when the science catches up with it, then, you know, that becomes another story. But until that happens, you know, we need to, you know, start talking about in the media about the new normal. You know, don't, you know, make fun of, you know, Asian countries that wear masks all the time to protect themselves, for instance. You know, tell a story about how it actually stops the spread and how, you know, places like, you know, Korea and some other, you know, developing countries like Vietnam of actually stopping the spread, because putting on a mask and going into the general public is a normal for them. For us, you know, I was out at HEB on yesterday, and I was just surprised by the number of people who didn't have on masks and gloves to go into the store. You know, I don't know if it was an act of defiance or ignorance, but I think...
You know, that's so interesting, James. I actually am going to be doing another podcast interview later today with someone talking about the constitutional crises during a pandemic, okay, or the constitutional perspective, because when Judge Lena Hidalgo came out and said, starting today, everybody in Harris County has to have a mask on, I was, you know, reading some things on social media and whatnot, and people are saying, oh, it's overreach, and, you know, you can't make me wear a mask, and I mean, I don't get it, and I don't understand why. Yes, I get the economic impact, but there's going to be no economy if we don't have our health, if we are not here and alive to participate in a robust and an active economy. And I think this way too soon. This is me speaking personally right now. This is my personal opinion. And I know there are people who disagree with me, but I think it's way too soon for us to be opening up. And I don't care if everything's open. I know I, for one, am not going to be going to any restaurant or to get my hair done or get my nails and my feet done. Not right now. And it's okay. I can stay hunkered down until the science says it's safe and okay, and we're not going to be putting each other in jeopardy. It just blows me away to see people, you know, at the beach now in California and in Florida. And it's like, what is it going to take for us to take the blinders off and see we are literally in a life and death situation? We lost 50,000 Americans in the last 30 days. Sadly, your dad was one of them, and my heart breaks for you. So nobody understands this better than you and those who have lost loved ones. Why are we not getting this message? I don't understand.
Well, you know, one person's overreach is another person's protection. And I think that when you saw the nurses in Denver who work in COVID units go and stand in defiance of with masks on in the middle of protesters who were standing next to each other with no masks, no protections, basically saying, you know, I don't care. I just want to get back to life as normal. Well, you know, life is normal. It's not going to happen until the science catches up with it. And so I thought, I read, you know, a lot of the tweets and social media stuff on when Lena Hidalgo decided that we need to continue to wear masks and I'm going to make it mandatory. I thought it was the smart thing to do. It's the smart thing to do when you don't know. You're supposed to take extra precaution to protect not only yourself, but other people. It's like vaccines. You know, you may be an anti-vaxxer, but I don't want your kid coming around my kid if that kid is not vaccinated. You know, I just don't want that. You know, so your freedom infringes on my right too. And so we need to figure out how we can do this, because we can't solve this with, you know, somebody because of a political affiliation feels that, okay, you know, you're stepping on my freedom. And oh, by the way, what does that have to do with the Second Amendment? You know,
just please don't even get me started. I know. It's just, it's ridiculous.
I know. My last days at the Chronicle, I worked as an opinion writer. And that's what I miss most. I left before the Obama administration, and I would have loved to have been a writer then, but I see some parallels, Linda, between what's happening now and what happened right after 9/11, with, you know, people being stereotyped, like Asian people being stereotyped, just like Muslims were stereotyped after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And You know, I think that is because people's fears, and they retreat to what they know most, and they retreat to what they feel most comfortable with, and sometimes that can result in, you know, racism and all those ugly things that contribute to this melting pot that we call America and this grand experiment in democracy. And so what I hope is that, you know, people come to their senses. People are opening up. I was appalled by some of the pictures of people sitting in barbershops and, you know, getting haircuts, not wearing a mask, and all the other things, the beaches that you reference. But, you know, for me, you know, at the most basic level, going to an HEB and seeing people walking around like nothing's going on, you know, like it's like it's okay to do this. My son was telling me about some of his peers. We were talking about COVID-19 and protecting yourself, and I was telling him that you have to be really careful because, you know, you could be asymptomatic as a young man and give it to somebody else. And he was telling, yo, Dad, I think that's crazy because some of my friends are going to kickback parties where large groups of people congregate in a small place because they are restless and have to do something. But what they don't understand is that, you know, if they're not following the protocol, that they could not only themselves get ill, but they can make other people ill. And again, it goes back to this thing is broken down by generational demographics and, you know, racial demographics. And it's all about the education. People are getting restless and they want to get back to life as normal. But as you said, life is normal. Life as normal is not going to happen until the science catches up with this virus. And I hope that, you know, people can appreciate and understand that. And I would hope that, you know, those people who are in positions of authority and influence, like elected officials, and, you know, church ministers, you know, I was just appalled that, you know, some churches were still gathering in light of this and knowing that their members could die.
It's just, you know, we've got, like you say, it's an educational process, but you know, it's life and death at this point. And seems... you know, in recent years, we've had so many attacks on the scientific community.
Yeah.
And if ever there were a wake-up call, this is it, that shows us that science matters. Yeah. It is the scientists and the doctors and the researchers who are literally saving our lives and our society as we know it.
Right.
So it matters.
Yeah.
It does matter. And we have to pay attention. We have to pay attention. The lives that are lost cannot be.
Matters too, Linda. Leadership matters.
Yes.
And, you know, words matter. And I don't have to tell you that the conversation for the last 3 or 4 days is the leader of the free world suggesting that people can, you know, inject disinfectants to cure the coronavirus or UV light. You know,
and that people have taken it seriously and have called authorities to say, can I do this?
Yes.
So, yes, words matter. I'm with you, brother. I am with you.
Yeah.
And gosh, there's so much more I could talk to you about. We'll have to do another catch up soon because I just think that, you know, we're obviously at a major tipping point in our society, on our planet.
Yeah.
And it's going to take some serious soul searching and all of us really working together and recognizing that we are one, we are all humans, and that's what, you know, this podcast has been about from the very beginning, which is reminding us of our common humanity. And the virus is doing that because it does not discriminate.
Yeah.
It does not discriminate.
Well, Linda, I've really enjoyed this discussion. And, you know, I was talking to one of our old colleagues, Melanie Lawson, who called me after my dad died. And she was the one that really convinced me to start really talking about this from my perspective. And she shared a story about when her mom died, Reverend Lawson, who everybody knows, Reverend Bill Lawson, who is the pastor emeritus at Wheeler Avenue Baptist Church. When she came back from a conference, Melanie flew back from a conference, and one of the first things her dad said to her is, "Now, you know, we got to do a video." I said, "Melanie, if your dad tells you that's the first thing he said, then I can definitely talk about this." And it's actually been cathartic to talk about it. So I really appreciate you inviting me on to do this. And, if you need me to, I can share, you know, some pictures with you of my dad.
And oh, please.
Even from the funeral service, pretty sad. I can send those to you.
And please do. We will definitely post them on the blog post that will go along with this podcast. And yeah. I can't thank you enough for being so open and honest and sharing how you're doing and what your experience was. And I think people will take quite a bit away from it. We just wish you and your family the best. Please, all of you, stay healthy. Stay safe, stay sane, and if there's anything I can do at all, just please let me know. And when it's time to celebrate your dad's life, I want to be right there with you celebrating.
Thank you, Linda. And tell Lou, all the best to your family, but tell Lou that I still remember that whooping he put on me in tennis. And tell him that, you know, he better be glad that he's aged out, because I would definitely, when my club opens up, I will definitely take him out there and whoop him for revenge.
Oh my goodness. You guys have to have a rematch. These two have had some epic tennis matches. Okay. He's going to be watching and listening. So I'll let you deliver this message yourself. James, okay. Love you so much. Take care, my friend.
All right, Linda. Thank you.
Okay. And thank all of you for watching and listening and for giving James permission to speak and having the courage to listen with an open mind. Please be safe, be well. We'll see you next time.